Good evening, and welcome to Tuesday Topics. My name's Paul Edwards, and I'm in beautiful Miami, Florida, where the temperature is about 70 degrees, and there's a gentle breeze blowing, and I just came in from my patio. I'd like to thank Steve Bauer for recording this evening's presentation, and in a little while I'll tell you about the other person who I really need to thank for work above and beyond this evening. I'd also like to thank Steve for the work that he is going to be doing editing this program, which turns the chaos of a live radio program into a reasonable sounding radio program. And obviously we'd like to thank George Byes of Talking Communities for making the software available that allows us to do Tuesday Topics and so many other shows on ACB Radio. Thank you, George. Without Talking Communities, we certainly wouldn't be very far along. This evening, we are presenting our program in a somewhat unusual way, in that we actually have a phone patch running through the Marlena Show mixer out in sunny Seattle, Washington. And Marlena has been kind enough to sort of act as our engineer. Our guest this evening, joining us by telephone, is Melanie Brunson from the ACB National Office, our executive director. And Melanie and I, for the first half hour or so of tonight's program, will be talking about an event which occurred today. And I won't steal Melanie's thunder by telling you at this point precisely what it is, though many of you may have seen announcements. I will tell you that it does have to do with an ongoing battle that ACB has been carrying on over the past 4 years to try to persuade the Department of the Treasury that it would be a good idea to create currency that blind people could distinguish the denominations of, and that that could be done in other ways than buying expensive $300 or $400 machines. So there actually now has been a decision in this case, but I think before we actually talk about the decision, maybe it would be a good idea if we laid some background. So first, Melanie, welcome to Tuesday Topics, and perhaps you could begin by talking to us a little bit about what the objective of ACB was and what actions we took 4 years ago and why we were forced to take those actions.
Thank you, Paul, and I'd be happy to do that. Let me just say first that it's fun to finally be on Tuesday Topics. I have seen most of the announcements about the program since its inception and haven't been able to participate yet, so I'm happy to have the chance to do that, especially on a day with events that in it that have been as significant as today's. We filed the lawsuit against the Treasury in 2002 after a number of years had elapsed during which ACB had made a variety of efforts to try to engage the Treasury Department in a dialogue about how to make paper currency identifiable to and by people with visual impairments. They had made one sort of concession, I guess, to folks with low vision by providing the large contrasting color. In fact, I'm not even sure if it's contrasting color. I don't remember. But they have the large numeral on the back of the bill. But the numeral's put in a position where it's on the back and it's in the corner, and there's only one. And so in order for a lot of people to even make use of it who can, they have to position their money in a way that most people who can see don't. And then it only is of value to those who can see well enough to see it. After 2002, the government became even more concerned about counterfeiting measures as well, and there was an effort undertaken to put into place a program whereby every so often new anti-counterfeiting features would be incorporated into the money. But even though they had set up a process of periodic redesign, they didn't include any accessibility features in their planning for that. And so we, after all these years of not getting a response, decided to file the lawsuit. And essentially what we said was that in failing to make their money independently identifiable and discernible by people with visual impairments and people who are blind, the Treasury has essentially denied meaningful access to paper currency, which is a service or a program of the federal government. And since Section 504 of the Rehab Act requires the government to make their programs and services accessible to people with disabilities, the Treasury Department and the Bureau of Printing and Engraving are in violation of Section 504 of the Rehab Act.
So essentially, we had done all that we could in terms of making contacts with them, in terms of trying to be nice guys, and so finally we filed suit. Well, that was 4 years ago. It is now late 2006. In the intervening 4 years, did the judge just sort of sit back and think for 4 years, or what actually happened during the case? How did the government respond? How are we forced to respond? And by the way, how did we manage to pay for all of this court action?
The judge didn't sit back and think, and we certainly didn't either. The government, I don't remember exactly what the time frame was, but within a relatively short time, the government had to answer our complaint, and they asked the judge to dismiss it, basically claiming that the government had no obligation under law to make the currency accessible, that to do so would constitute an undue burden on the government as well as on business in the country, and it would also be infeasible, and therefore the judge should dismiss our action. The judge refused to do that because the judge said that there were enough issues of fact to warrant a continuation of the case. And at that point, then, the attorneys entered into the discovery process, which is basically involves each side trying to get a lot of information out of the other side. And our attorney and I spent a lot of hours answering questions from the government's attorneys about everything from, you know, prove to us that you've tried to contact the Department of Treasury, give us copies of the letters and dates of phone calls and who you corresponded with and what they said, to, you know, who were the board members and when did they vote on this decision, and all kinds of things. We, in turn, submitted a lot of questions to the government on, you know, how do you know it's going to be, how do you know it's an undue burden, what's it going to cost, what are you basing your figures on, who did you get the information from, you know, what experts did you consult, lots of different things. And then last year, they spent, the government's attorneys came out and took depositions of myself on behalf of ACB and both of the individual plaintiffs, Pat Sheehan and Otis Stevens. And that took, mine took 2 days, and theirs each took a whole day each. So we did all of that, and then in May, I believe it was, the discovery ended, and the judge called all the lawyers into chambers, and they made oral arguments in front of the judge, and the judge asked both of the attorneys a lot of questions, and this then asked them to submit some further information to him, and this decision then is his next step in the process. Our attorney is a gentleman who has a federal court practice in Washington, D.C., and is at this point very interested in the case and is handling it pro bono, meaning we are not paying him. So we are incredibly fortunate, and he has done a really good job in presenting on our behalf and working with us on it. So it's been a very, very good, he was a good find.
And his name is, if it, and I assume it's not a secret at this point.
Oh no, his name is Jeffrey Lovitky, L-O-V-I-T-K-Y. He has a sole practice in Washington D.C.
Well, we were really fortunate to find someone who was prepared to do that, and this was not at all an easy road for either you as executive director and as government affairs person when all this started to have walked either. I know as a board member, we were constantly being asked to reaffirm our commitment to this issue, and we were kind of surprised at just what a difficulty we were having in making this matter seem important to the federal government, where to us anyway as board members it seemed like a kind of a slam dunk decision. So that brings us to today, and the judge essentially made a decision, and perhaps we have now reached the point where you ought to tell us what that decision was.
We won. That was the initial reaction in the office, and you probably heard it all the way in Seattle. The judge essentially said that the government is in violation of Section 504 of the Rehab Act, that they need to make currency accessible to people who are blind and visually impaired, and that they did not make their case. That it is not an undue burden. Their arguments were not persuasive. If all those other countries in the world can do it, there's no reason why we can't. The government has 10 days to appeal, and I suspect that they will. But if for some reason they choose not to, then the judge will set a status conference for sometime within the next 30 days, I believe it is, or sometime after the first of the year, and the parties will get together and figure out how to proceed from there in terms of pursuing the judge's order. He did not say, you know, you have to incorporate these particular features into the money. So I would suppose that should the government not appeal, that would be the next thing, is to try to figure out with the Treasury what the Treasury's attorneys what to do from there under supervision of the court. I don't know exactly. I haven't discussed that in detail with our attorney, so I'm just guessing at this point.
Let's begin by putting the whole appeal process into context. This case was decided at the lowest level of federal court, which means that it is currently presumably binding in that judicial district only, and they would appeal to the Court of Appeals in that particular judicial district. Is that correct?
That's correct, in the Fourth Circuit. D.C. Court of Appeals. It's not the D.C. Court of Appeals. It's the United States Court of Appeals. So, but yes, the decisions are binding in the particular circuit, or in this case, the district. But the appeals court decision, when that comes down, would be binding in that circuit. But other judges do take note of what other circuits are deciding. But essentially, yes, it would be binding in this circuit if it came down.
It will go to the Court of Appeals, and that's typically a three-judge panel. And we would be required to make oral arguments again, as they would. But essentially, I would think that it's actually going to be a good deal harder for them to prove, because now that a judge has actually created a case in law, I think it's going to be very much more difficult for them to win an appeal. Would you agree with that?
I think that's possible. A lot depends on the judges in the circuit, and I think I've heard mixed reviews about this particular circuit. But I do think that every time any attorney has a judge at any level rule against him, it does make it harder for him or her to make his case, particularly if you have, you know, been pretty aggressive in your presentation at the beginning, which the government was. So I'm not really sure. I would like to think you're right, because I think what I've heard from some folks is that this district is pretty fair. And if that is the case, then I think they will probably view it in a manner similar to what Judge Robertson did.
I haven't, of course, read his full decision, but if we take some of the components of the news stories and put them together, his arguments were a lot, it seemed to me anyway, based on refutations of some of the government's claims. So that, for example, their argument of undue burden was countered by his claim that the only evidence that he had of costs was that they conceivably wouldn't cost more than 5% for them to make the kinds of changes that are likely to be required, even though he made it clear that he wasn't going to tell them exactly what it was that they should do in order to create accessible currency. And the other really telling fact, I think, that I noticed was the claim that there are 180 countries that have currency, and over 100 of them, many of them not huge countries, already have some method for making certain that their currency is accessible. And I think that was, especially since he talked about it today, appeared to have been an important consideration for him, that there are so many other countries that have already made that decision that the United States ought to be able to make that too. And I guess the court supervision is an interesting feature, because sometimes a court can simply make a decision. And do you find it unusual that he made a decision to say, if you don't appeal this decision, then you're going to have to work out the details with me?
No, I think what he specifically said was that there would be a status conference. And a status conference is where all the parties get together and essentially discuss the status of the case, and come up with oftentimes the judge will encourage them to settle or encourage them to come up with a plan for implementing his order. So that's all that is. And that's a fairly common process. I don't know that necessarily means that he will take an active role in any discussions of, you know, features or those kinds of things, but he would probably, you know, try to get the attorneys to sit down and come up with a plan for what are you going to do next to get rolling on implementing the order. For instance, getting the two attorneys to agree to set up a meeting between I don't know, the representatives of the Treasury and other folks that might need to be involved in discussing how to make currency accessible. It's not that the judge is necessarily going to be real involved. It's simply that the judge is going to get the parties together to have a conference about how they're going to be involved in implementing the decision.
And this is perhaps an unfair question, but do you have any real sense as to why the government took such an off the wall negative position all the way through this case? I mean, I would have thought, and that's why I'm raising the question, I would have thought that they would have recognized that this is pretty much of a slam dunk case. Because of the situation, and one wonders why they didn't kind of once the court was out there go meekly and kind of accept their fate. What do you think impelled them to take such a strong negative approach?
I don't really know for certain. I had thought initially when we filed that we might end up in settlement negotiations as well, and was kind of surprised that they didn't. I don't honestly know for certain. It could be, and this is pure speculation on the part of Melanie Bronson, but it could be that some of the folks in the government, in that division of the Justice Department that's handling the case, were of the opinion that they should fight it, and so they did. I don't know. I do know that there are some blind attorneys in the Justice Department, or were at the time, who were fairly high placed, who are not necessarily supporters of ACB's position on this. And I don't know whether they had anything to do with it or not. I kind of suspected they might have from some of the questions that the attorneys from the Justice Department asked me.
Interesting. And I suppose their argument would be that there are sufficient ways, or you can fold bills, or you can do other things in order to somehow get around some of that. Just to complete this component or this element, once it goes to the next level, that is to the District Court of Appeals, let's make the assumption that the District Court of Appeals upholds our decision and the government decides that they're going to appeal again. If they decide to do that, where would they be appealing to then?
I don't know my civil procedure well enough to know whether there would be an intervening appeal for it to a full what they call en banc convening of the Court of Appeals, whereby all of the judges in the circuit listen to a case, or whether at that point it would go directly to the Supreme Court. But if there isn't an en banc appeal, then it would go, the Supreme Court would be, the U.S. Supreme Court would be the next place.
It would be interesting to see the case find its way there, especially given the current constitution of the court. We certainly know that the ADA has probably been weakened, and that the Supreme Court, except in a couple of decisions, have taken decisions that are pretty narrowly supportive when they are of the ADA. There haven't been a lot of cases, though, that have surrounded Section 504, and there's a feeling, or at least there's a feeling in my head, that Section 504 seems to be safer law and less open to question. Do you believe that it's going to be a little harder for the Treasury to persuade a conservative court to overturn 504 because of the state of law?
I do. I think that that you're right. Section 504 is a little more concrete, and there isn't a lot of case law on it, which in this instance is a good thing, because the fewer cases there are, the more opportunity you have to distinguish yours from them, because fact situations and premises of law are not always identical, and you can make distinctions in many cases, and quite honestly, it is my belief that the language in Section 504 is not as vague. I mean, it specifically says, you know, that agencies of the federal government are supposed to make their programs, activities, and services accessible to people with disabilities. Now, you know, arguably, well, we have access to money. We just don't know which one it is we've got access to. But, and so the judge said, you know, but that access isn't meaningful. And I think that is a fairly compelling argument, even to people of a fairly conservative political views.
I think the other factor that I would look at is, unlike the ADA, there actually has been action taken by Congress in the middle to late 1980s with the Civil Rights Restoration Act, which essentially reaffirmed what Congress's notion of what Section 504 was and struck down some of the narrower interpretations that had been made by courts and by the government itself in the early 1980s.
That's correct as well.
Let's talk for a minute about some of the things that did come out of the case, and we're actually approaching the place where I'm going to open this for questions or comments from other folks, but it's pretty clear what our arguments are. But to be fair to the government, let's spend a little time talking about some of their concerns, because these are going to be the practical issues that they're going to have to face now. I know that one of the issues that they raised pretty early on was that creating bills of different sizes would create a huge problem, not just for them in terms of manufacturing bills, but also for outside entities who operated vending machines. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about what some of those arguments were.
Essentially, yeah, they did. That was a big portion of their case. And what they essentially were concerned about was that businesses would have to retool, ATM machines would have to be redesigned to accommodate different size bills. Vending machines would have to be redesigned. They even mentioned, I believe, at one point, money drawers, cash registers, and other types of containers that business people use to store varying denominations of money would all have to be redesigned, and that could be a significant, if not totally disruptive, burden on the economy and on the ability of business to stay afloat. And so they were concerned about what that would do to the industry of vending in particular and banking in the country.
I've seen some currencies that are differentiated by size, sometimes by length and sometimes by width. It depends on the currency. Obviously, in Canada, some attempts have been made to actually put Braille markings onto the corners of bills. Did you guys do any research, and you don't necessarily have to know the answer to this question, that discovered some other ways that other countries were, in fact, distinguishing among paper currency?
The other way that we did come across was the use of intaglio printing that enables the printer to make the printing raised so that the pattern of the printing is tactual on the piece of paper. And things like the euro is one example of a currency where those different patterns of in the printing, you can't necessarily read the numbers and the letters, but you can tell that there's a different design on each denomination of bills in the manner in which that printing, how the raised portion of the printing feels on the paper. So that's the other big thing that's being done in a number of countries, in addition to size. And the Canadian ones aren't really Braille; they're just different combinations of dots in the corners. And each denomination has a different combination or a different pattern made by the dots in the corner.
We've talked a lot about the facts of the case and so on. But maybe you could tell us a little bit about the actual occurrence of the decision, how you found out about it, what your response was, and what sorts of things have already begun to happen at the ACB National Office so that people can get a sense of how big a deal this actually is.
It's been huge. I have to admit, even I was surprised at how quickly it spread. I actually found out about it from a reporter from the Bloomberg News Service who called and said that he had a question about the currency case. And so the call was passed to me, and I got on the phone. He said, well, I'm calling because I'd like to get someone's comment about the decision in the currency case. And I said, oh, what was the decision? I said, I haven't even heard anything yet, and I'm holding my breath. Waiting to see what the decision was, and he told me that the judge had refused to grant the government summary judgment and had in fact granted summary judgment in behalf of the American Council of the Blind. And I said, yay. And so I said, so I guess that's not probably the sort of answer that you really want to print. So my official comment is that this is very good news, and it's a significant victory for people who are blind, and we are very pleased. the phone started ringing off the hook from there. Within the next 5 minutes, I didn't even have a chance to call the attorney till about 15 minutes later, because I immediately had, apparently what had happened was that AP, or somebody, I guess Bloomberg had gotten it off of the district court's website. And almost immediately, AP sent something out, and so everybody else started picking it up. And within the first half hour, I had calls from Fox News in Chicago and KNX Radio in Los Angeles and the CBS radio in New York. And then they had a call from FoxNews.com. And within an hour or so, we had calls from several Fox affiliates, as well as two different shows on NPR. And just before we got on the phone tonight, Day had called me to say that she needed Chris's phone number because Good Morning America was looking for someone whom they could send a film crew to talk about the decision, and wanted somebody either on the East Coast or in California where they had film crews. So it's going all over the place very quickly. And and the Washington Times called fairly quickly as well. So the media is very interested, and interestingly enough, quite, for the most part, fairly sympathetic. It's like, well, good grief, this is something that never thought about, but it should have been done a long time ago, don't you think? And it kind of has been their approach. So it's been an interesting day.
No, I bet it has. I talked a little bit about this before, but I think it really behooves us to say that much of the weight of this lawsuit was carried by Melanie in Washington, D.C., right from the beginning in 2002, when it was decided that we would file the case. She was director of government affairs then, and essentially had virtually full responsibility for trying to assure that lawsuit would go forward, and has been the point person all the way through it. And I think it's probably safe to say, without her hard work and without a lot of effort on her part, we would not be where we are today. Because even though it's pretty easy to talk in a short program about some of the issues that were raised, there were huge numbers of hours that had to be spent gathering information, acquiring documents, answering ridiculous questions that were raised by the government, just in order to get us to the place where we are today. And it really is a tribute to ACB, to Chris and his leadership, as well as to Melanie, that we actually have gotten as far as we have. And on behalf of Tuesday Topics, I'd certainly like to congratulate you, Melanie. Let me give you an opportunity to perhaps respond to this and maybe with some final thoughts before I open it up for some questions from other folks.
Well, thank you. And that was very kind of you. And I think, you know, for me, it has been an interesting and sometimes difficult experience. I did pull in a lot of other people and get a lot of feedback from others as I tried to provide information from the attorney. And particularly, I want to say, too, that Otis Stevens and Pat Sheehan were individual plaintiffs along with us. The attorney wanted one person who was blind and one person who had low vision to be the individual plaintiffs, and those two gentlemen volunteered. And they really were run through the ringer in the course of particularly the depositions about why they were, you know, what made them think they were representative, for instance. And so they really did bear a lot of the burden as well. And so I need to commend them for their perseverance and their willingness to have their name attached to the case, because you know, we weren't sure how this was going to go when we started out, and we're still not sure how it's going to end. But I told the attorney today, you know, that you know, he did a good job, and that you know, we'll hang with him as far as he's willing to go with it. So I think there's a lot of congratulating to go all around.
Ladies and gentlemen who are out there, please remember to identify who you are and where you are, and then feel free to make whatever comment you'd like, or hopefully to raise some questions that perhaps we haven't covered in our discussion of the currency case so far. So let's see who's first.
Hi, it's Sue from Port Hadlock, and I just want to congratulate Melanie, and it'll be interesting to hear. It'd be great to have Pat or Otis or both of them on the show maybe another time to get their perspective as plaintiffs. And I know it's not easy to be deposed, especially for 2 days. So anyway, good work, Melanie, and I bet the national office was a happy place today.
It was indeed. We were all cheering and running around, but we didn't get to do too much celebrating because we had to answer questions, so we'll have to figure out a time to do that.
Hello, this is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. I was wondering, how much of a problem would it be, though, to put Braille on bills? Would it not last, or would it wear out like a 1 on 1, 5, 10, 20, 50, you know, 100? How much of a problem would it actually be to do Braille on a bill?
I don't know, but I think the fear is that it wouldn't last because it would get to the point where you wouldn't be able to tell that it was there, because Braille kind of smashes fairly easily. But on the other hand, I don't know really how much of a problem that would be, because nobody's tried it yet that I'm aware of. So that's something that we're going to have to try to do a lot, figure out some ways to do some checking into to see what kinds of information we can gather about just how workable the various options are.
This is Marlena in Seattle, and when I've looked at Canadian money, and I've seen some pretty worn down bills, and you could still feel the patterns. Of course, I didn't know what they meant, but I could still feel that the patterns were there. And I mean, they weren't completely worn down, but they were reasonably well-used bills, mm-hmm. as well as some reasonably new ones. My question goes back to your comment about some, I think you said, highly placed blind attorneys in the Department of Justice who opposed this concept. What was their opposition? I can't imagine any blind person in good conscience opposing this, so I'm curious to hear some of their specific concerns, if you know them.
Well, what I do know is that at some point, some of the discussion with government attorneys involved, whether or not it reflected ill of blind people and gave the public the perception that blind people weren't capable when they asked the government to make this sort of to take the steps to provide them with this kind of an accommodation. Didn't it make it seem to the public like blind people aren't able to handle their own affairs? Wouldn't it make people think that blind people shouldn't be employed in positions of responsibility if they can't even handle their own money? So wouldn't it be better for blind people to just blend in and use the methods that they've used in the past to compensate on their own for the lack of accessibility?
I'm actually going to ask you a question of fact, not a question that should require speculation. I haven't seen any comment made by the NFB, pro or con, since this lawsuit started. And my question to you is, have you seen any statements from the NFB at this point with regard to accessible currency?
I had not seen any either since the suit was filed. Day just told me just before I left that some piece of media coverage that she saw on the web quoted somebody who purported to be from the public relations office of the NFB, and they made the statement that this was unfortunate because it was not it did not represent a major issue that's of major importance to blind people, and that it was only a distraction from the real issues that blind people are concerned about.
Hi, Melanie. This is Cheryl from Miami, and I'm curious what you think about job opportunities once currency is made accessible. Do you think that blind people will be and visually impaired people will be able to hold jobs as cashiers and other things that they never were able to do before?
Well, I think that's a possibility. I know, for instance, that I've spoke with some vendors who said that they, you know, of course, they have occasion to run cash registers, and they have said that they never used to like to use note tellers because it took the note teller too long to identify the money. So they preferred, you know, just relying on people's honesty and hoping they were right, or else having a sighted assistant there to identify the money, because it took too long to run it through the note tellers, and that slowed them way down, and the customers got mad. So I think that to that extent, the current way of doing things does present some challenges for a blind person who wants to be a merchant, and so it seems to me that there would be some improvements in our ability to do that kind of work, at least more efficiently, if currency is readily identifiable by a blind person.
Hi, this is Larry from Phoenix, and I do have a question. I'm reading an article right now about this very issue, and it's talking about the expense of what the Treasury might face in terms of giving our money a facelift so it's accessible. And understand, I do support this absolutely. I'm extremely pleased with what's happened. But one thought that I had, and it's mentioned in this article, is how, if at all, and you may or may not be able to answer this, how this might impact the industry of vending machines, changing the money and that sort of thing. Was this talked about in court and part of the discussions at all? Because I'm kind of curious about it.
It was talked about a lot by the government. That was one of the elements in their undue burden case, was the impact that making currency accessible would have on the vending machine industry, because they'd have to retool. But, you know, the fact of the matter is they may or may not. I mean, it is a possibility. But, you know, interestingly enough, you know, but the only way they would really have to retool is if part of the accessibility features involved dramatically changing the size or shape of the currency. And as Marlena pointed out a little while ago, you know, there's already one country that, Canada, that just uses embossed dots on theirs to make them accessible. There's also countries that are doing things with intaglio printing, and neither of those measures would have any impact at all on how vending machines handle the money, or the size and shape of the mechanism for inserting it and making it come out. So it doesn't necessarily have to be something that would grossly impair the ability of the industry to cope. It's you know, there are, and there may be something else that's available that, you know, we haven't even thought of yet. The point of it is that they need to do something, and if they want to incorporate into that something the needs of the vending industry as well as the needs of blind people, then fine and dandy. But let's do something.
Hi, this is Jim Slagel of Princeton, New Jersey. First of all, congratulations. Along those lines, you know, vending machines would be even easier to use dollar coins than dollar bills. And, you know, in the last 100 years, we've had an inflation of, like, 20-fold inflation. And we didn't used to have paper money for half dollars, quarters, dimes, and nickels. But the only way that they're going to come out with, you know, as you know, the new dollar coins, the presidents. But what, by experience, And I think that's going to succeed, but the only way to do it is to really withdraw the dollar bills, the paper ones, and have the dollar coins. And, of course, this would be very good for blind people because they can identify coins very well. And, by the way, while they're at it, they could eliminate the pennies.
I'm sorry, they could eliminate what?
The pennies. I mean, we didn't used to have 1/20th of a penny 100 years ago. We don't need a penny coin anymore. And, you know, we get rid of the penny and then add the dollar coin. And, of course, that would save the Treasury a lot of money, too. The dollar coins are way cheaper for the Treasury than dollar bills.
Well, I know that, you know, that issue has been around a while, too. And in fact, interestingly enough, we are going to be talking with the Mint tomorrow about the new dollar coins that are proposed because they're concerned, the Mint's concerned about whether they're going to present accessibility challenges for people who are blind. So it's kind of funny because the Mint responds to us, but the Treasury, the Bureau of Printing and Engraving, hasn't wanted to. There are things that that can be done and to compensate, and it is an assumption to just say, oh, it's going to be so expensive, we can't do it. You know, Japan has accessible yen, and they have more vending machines than this country ever thought of having, apparently. So it'd be interesting to see. I mean, they did it; they made the transition. The euro has accessible features, and all of the countries in the European Union made the transition, and some of them have a lot smaller gross national product than we do. And their industries have managed to survive the transition. So I think that we could all, you know, work together to make something happen. And certainly there are other issues. I mean, the government redesigns money anyway now for national security purposes. And while they're not doing anything tactile, they're certainly redesigning it every so often, and they're going to be doing it again. So it's not that great a leap.
I guess I wanted to put something else on the table, and that is that in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, I'm pretty sure about New Zealand, I'm positive about Canada and Australia, they actually use $2 coins as well, and for the most part, don't start using paper currency until you get to the $5 bill. And they would argue, I think, and quite rightly, that in fact that works extremely well for them, and that it's made the design of their vending machines a lot easier, and also has in fact limited the operation of bills to $5 and up, and that certainly may be an option that we could consider, though it's a little radical.
Hi, everyone. Melanie, I really want to congratulate you on this. I know what you've put into it. I think it's wonderful that you finally have gotten as far as you have with it. As far as the machines are concerned, the vending machines are concerned, I think one of the other issues that I haven't heard pointed out throughout the last several months on this is vending machines now, with very few exceptions, only recognize $1 bills. They had to go through and retrofit them, fit most vending machines for the new currency, quote unquote, the new 5s, 10s, 20s, and such. But most machines only recognize $1 bills. If you put a $10 bill into most snack machines, it's only going to give you credit for $1. There are some that won't, but the vast majority are only going to recognize a dollar. The ones that will recognize more than that are usually ones that accept that are for very high-end items that have huge profit margins on them. You know, there are some machines where you can buy like a disposable camera, that kind of thing. Those, I don't think that it, I think that's a whole separate issue as to whether or not that's an undue burden on those machine companies to have to go back in and retrofit them. They all managed to retrofit them for the new paper currency that we have now.
Well, that's true, and that's a very familiar voice, and indeed you do know what I went through because I complained to you a lot about it. Terry, it's good to talk to you, and thanks.
Well, I figured out how I can tell the difference. I put money in certain places, like fives and back of ones, and in the billfold I have a compartment, and then I fold tens one way and twenties another way. But I like the idea of currency like coins, $1, $2 coins. But I like the old silver dollars that I used to have. They were big coins. They were bigger than the 50-cent pieces. I like those things. I don't know how you do it with $2 unless you rub the edges off or something. One thing to put in the mix, too, is I'm wondering with the way technology is and electronics work gradually entering into what is known as a cashless society. What do you people think of that situation?
That's an interesting observation, too. You know, you could argue, well, just, you know, tell all the blind people to use credit cards. You know, and then they won't have to worry about it. But, you know, as long as we have cash and everybody else is using it, I don't think that's going to be a reasonable argument. And I don't even think that the folks who oppose the case would make that kind of an argument. But certainly, you know, one option is and there'd be a number of reasons for wanting to do it, to increase the number of coins for smaller denominations and use paper only for the large ones. It might be that the government will decide that it's cheaper that way. I don't know.
One of our listeners just put a text message up, which essentially indicated that what the Treasury has touted, its large print denominational markings are on the back and they are in the corners, and according to this person anyway, are not that easy to use. They do have markings on everything from the 1 through the 50, but those markings are not, according to this person, very easy for low vision folks to use.
That is my understanding. Folks with low vision have told me that it's hard because of where they're positioned for them. They basically have to put all their money upside down and facing the wrong way in their wallets, and it drives them crazy because they're not used to putting them that way. But in order to actually be able to access them fast enough, that's what they have to do.
Yeah, I never understood why the Treasury wouldn't make the numerals really large, very, very large, and also change colors so the $1 bill would be a different color from the $5, you know, very obviously. This also, by the way, would help sighted people, 20/20 people, because they could recognize money, you know, from a greater distance very easily. So it would help everybody. And it would cost, you know, when they redesign the currency, it costs them nothing to change, you know, to have a certain color or big numbers on the bills as opposed to small ones.
This is Larry again in Phoenix. I threw up the comment about the contrast of the bills. I have pretty low vision and find that often I'm frantically trying to identify my money. It's really not very easy. And the one, if I'm remembering correctly, I've got one here, I'll look, and the $1 bill, it doesn't have the same contrast in terms of the typeface they use that the other bills do. But regarding the comment about different colors, I've been to other countries. I've been to Jamaica, and their money, is at least when I was there in 1989, was different colors. I believe it still is. And I even spent some time in Haiti, and if I remember right, their money is different colors. So if countries like that can do that, there's no reason we can't.
There are, you know, the fact of the matter is most features that would help us would also be usable by a lot of other people who don't have visual impairments, and would make it easier for everybody. I mean, how many people who have 20/20 vision have ever been in a dark place where they've wanted to have access to money and had to find a flashlight on their key or something in order to figure out what bill they had? There are a lot of cases, folks with cognitive disabilities or folks with learning disabilities. A lot of people who are older who have never considered themselves to be legally blind would benefit from more ways to determine the right bill. And they may never get to a rehab facility that's going to teach them how to fold their money in different ways, and they may not think of doing that. It's not like we're asking to be singled out and given any special treatment. We're asking for something that could have benefits for a large portion of the population and a portion that's only going to increase in number as the years go by.
Melanie, thank you very much for devoting a little more than an hour of your time on a really, really tough evening for you where you've got lots of other demands on your time. We truly appreciate it on Tuesday Topics that you've been prepared to spend some time with us and discuss with us this exciting victory for ACB. And I hope that all of us will go back to our affiliates and go back to everyone who says, what has ACB done for me lately? And say, well, I tell you what, we have a victory that we can point to right now, which has two guys' names on it who are members of ACB, but also has the name the American Council on the Blind on it. So let me let Melanie make any final comments that she may have, and then we will end tonight's program.
Well, thank you, Paul. I did enjoy being able to come. This is really my celebration, talking with friends about the case, and I appreciate the opportunity to be with you. And thank you, Marlena, for making it possible, because I'm still a Luddite. I have a computer, but I don't have a microphone, so I've never been able to join you on another occasion. And I was happy that Marlena was able to intervene and make it possible for me to do that tonight.
Tuesday Topics this evening has celebrated the victory that's occurred today with a court decision in Washington, D.C., which categorically upholds ACB's position that the government ought to be interested in creating currency that can be individually identified by individuals who are blind and visually impaired. I hope that you will join us again next week when we will be discussing another exciting topic on Tuesday Topics, and that you'll keep listening to ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday, 1 hour Universal Time. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. The first time you enter the chat room, the software will automatically download and install on your computer. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each show begins, those online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room service and how it works. An announcement promoting the topic to be discussed will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends list early each week. So we hope you will come and join us Tuesday each week when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. Again, the URL is ourplace.acbradio.org.